Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's talk. My name is Anne-Marie Boylan, and I'm a senior researcher in the Health Experiences Research Group. I'm also the module coordinator for the Masters in Evidence-Based Healthcare module on qualitative research methods. And this evening's talk is part of that module, and you're all very welcome. It's great to see so many smiling faces here. I'd like to introduce you to Dr. John McCartney, who's a colleague of mine in the Health Experiences Research Group. He's a senior researcher and a sociologist of health and illness, and his particular interest is in cancer diagnosis, end-of-life care, palliative care, and bereavement. And he's previously worked in Australia as well as here, and has most recently been working on an international sort of comparative study about cancer diagnosis across England, Sweden and Denmark. He's here this evening to talk to us about how qualitative researchers approach analysis, which I know the students on the master's course are going to be very interested in. So over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, and thanks for coming this evening. A little introduction to myself, and Anne-Marie has very helpfully done that. I think the only thing I will add to that is a question that I ask myself whenever I'm doing my research. And when I'm trying to think about my research as a sociologist, because that's primarily how I approach my work, is the question of how we understand ourselves as we do, or how sometimes I will ask, how do these participants understand themselves as they do? Okay, and that is going to be a theme that goes through the talk today, and how I try and convince you that a sociological approach to qualitative research, which is something I'm going to focus on, a particular style of qualitative research, is useful and is a productive way to do qualitative research. So this talk, I'm going to focus in on exploring what we mean by description and interpretation. I think start to look at the difference between those two things and how they relate to each other, and start to get you to think about those things in your research as qualitative researchers. Part of that will be to help develop our reflexive capacity, or what I would call as a sociologist, our sociological imagination, by considering how the categories that we use can affect our analysis. And we're going to go through a few examples of how we do that. And as the talk is titled about Up and Out in Your Research, we're going to work through an example of how to develop a thematic analysis up and out. So as you're probably learning, for those of you on the master's course, there's lots of different types of qualitative research, narrative, phenomenological content, etc. I'm going to just take a nice simplified thematic analysis rather than simplified thematic analysis and take that up and out and show you how we might want to start doing that. What do I mean by up and out? This is a little diagram. You know, you've got your data and you've done your field work, you've got all the data collected, and this presumes some sort of ethnographic type approach. So you will have done some interviews, made some field notes, maybe taken some photographs, got some video data. So you've got all your data, you've organised it, you've worked out what sort of data you've got, you've coded it, you've gone through your NVivo, or you've used your post-it notes, or however you want to do that. And again, you will have been probably talking about that earlier in the week. And what we're going to focus on is this sort of third stage here, where we describe the data, we use some classifications, we interpret it, and we start to abstract, we start to move away from the raw data itself. I've described this here as 3A and 3B. 3A is sort of moving up, how we get to the data and how we move away from it a little bit, start to put some distance between the data itself and our approach to it, and we describe and interpret it. That's going to be the main part of this talk today, the up parts, but the moving out is built into that, and that's sort of the up is the first out of the out, if that makes sense. And so we're going to move, show you some of the examples of ways you might think about going out towards more conceptual approaches, approaching the theory, and how that might affect your research. So, why is this important? Okay, this is important for qualitative research for a number of reasons. We're all probably, I imagine most of us in this room, are aware that qualitative research regularly receives a bit of a thumping and gets critiqued for various reasons, critiqued for epistemological reasons about what is known and about what you can say about qualitative research. I'm not really going to address that. If you look at the podcast for this, Evidence-Based Medicine, there's a really good talk by Trish and there's a really good talk by Axel about qualitative research, and I suggest you go and have a look at those. And Trish in particular talks about the ontologies in qualitative research and about who speaks and about how we can understand who's speaking. And those are sort of important issues for qualitative research. We need to take that into account when we do our analysis. Okay? These are unavoidable problems. There's no, we will work it out and then we'll have a solution. Every time you do qualitative research, you will reapproach these issues. Certainly that's my opinion. And you have to work them through. And that's part of doing qualitative research. And we'll see how that's built into the various methods and methodologies that you take on. And for this reason, you need to understand the costs and benefits of any decisions you make as you go through your analysis. Okay? So, and this is where I like to say, if I've got a student, I say, bias is your business. Okay? This is what you need to do. You need to learn to own your bias. How does your bias affect what you're doing? The qualitative research is very much entangled within those biases. There's no randomizing it, there's no blinding yourself from it. You are biased. You need to work out how that's affecting your research and how that's affecting the output. Okay, and you write that into your research, and this is what we're going to look at today, the working up and out, and how you justify that, and how that becomes a robust approach to doing your research. Okay, and you are the research method. That's quite an anthropological statement, but anthropologists try and find where they are in their research, and that's part of that process. Okay, and really important to this is, therefore, is reflexivity. Okay, and you can't do qualitative research without being reflexive. You need to understand who you are in relation to your data. Okay, and you need to account for that. And the better you can account for that, the more robust and the better appreciated your data will be by other researchers. You really need to be aware of how you see others seeing. Okay, and there's just no easy ways around that, as we'll see. But there is lots of ways to help you think about how you do that. So, let's start with a little example. I know it's a late evening. It's warm in this room, a bit stuffy, but just tell me what you might see. Describe what is happening here. Just very simple. What's the scene? Who? We have a doctor and we have a... Okay, so what might be happening?
Well, they're having a consultation, by the looks of it, but there's a sort of slight shift in this person standing up with their stethoscope and their wire and a pen. And the other person sitting down looking adoring
the actor. Brilliant, excellent. Any other interpretations of what might be, or descriptions of what might be happening here? Everybody happy with that as a consensus view? But that perfectly well could be what's happening here. Absolutely. We could flip this around though. We could say this isn't a doctor-patient relationship. We could say this is a teaching relationship. And this is a professor of surgery, and this is the student. And she's sat down because she's the boss and she's been on her feet all day, and this student will stand up and listen carefully and take some notes, right? So we've got two categories, doctor, patient, teacher, student, and how we understand those categories understands how we interpret the world. That's it. That's the whole talk, okay? If you've got that, hold on to it, because I'm going to try and confuse you and bring you out the other end. But that's it. That's all we're doing in qualitative research is looking at the categories we use, how they're making us understand the data, and trying to think about other categories and how they might help us understand that data in a different way. Okay? And we work with that. So, I'm going to make this point several times, just in case we didn't get it, and you go through some of the examples. Here's another one. This is one that, when I was doing my PhD, I read this book, and I saw this, and it made me laugh, and it just stuck with me. So, what are animals? And this is an example from Foucault's The Order of Things. Animals in ancient China, where they belong to the emperor. This is how they understood animals. If you ask somebody what is an animal, they would say they belong to the emperor. These are some examples of animals. You could draw an animal with fine camel hair bush, and from a long way off, they look like flies. That's what an animal is. This is the taxonomy of animals, this is the category of animals, and this is how we understand it. Okay? Now that sounds alien to us, it doesn't make any sense, but that was a way of understanding the world. Of course, we know animals in a completely different way. We have a very specific taxonomy. We can describe them in other ways. But that's how we understand them within our culture, within our society, and the science that we use, and it helps us to organise the world. And there's no necessarily right or wrong here, but these are just of their time. These are the categories that we used, and that's how we understood them. Okay? So these categories, they shape our interpretation. And this quote, as you can see, the little question I ask myself when I'm doing research, this is where it comes from. And the wonderment of this taxonomy, reflecting on what we've just looked at, is the thing that is demonstrated by looking at another system of thought is a limitation of our own, the stark impossibility of thinking that. Okay, and this is a little bit what we're trying to do. We're trying to make alien the common sense assumptions that we have when we're doing our research. How is this mundane way we understand the world, how can we make that sort of different and alien to us so that we can think about it critically and understand where it's come from and how it might be shaping other aspects of our life and other aspects of our research. So we can start to see the way we describe things affects the way we interpret things, but also the way we interpret things starts to affect the way we describe things. And this is a very circular thing. There's an example here from phenomenological studies. So, you know, these are general principles you could apply in qualitative research. And if you're going to take a phenomenological approach, there's some background here. With Edmund Husserl and Martin Heidegger had two different approaches to this question. One prioritised interpretation, one prioritised description, and so on prior to the other. Now, this is a very philosophical debate that they got into. What I want to point to and want to get to start thinking about it is a methodological issue. Okay, so we're not trying to work out what's the answer to this question. We're just trying to use this problem as a way to think about our data. This is more methods than, you know, philosophy. So an easier example. The baby cried, the mummy picked it up. Really simple description, okay? Two sentences. And if just as a little aside, if you're ever worried you don't have enough data in qualitative research, these two sentences, Harvey Sachs wrote two lectures on, okay? You always have enough data. You might just not have the right questions to get the most out of that data, okay? So don't worry about, I need to do another 15 interviews sometimes. You know, just remember, it's the questions you're asking of that data sometimes. Anyway, that's an aside. Harvey Sachs, he was a conversation analyst. In the 60s, he very sadly, tragically died in a car accident. That's why we only have mostly lectures from him. But what he's saying about this, the baby cried, the mummy picked it up. We can really start to, you know, there's enough in there for us to imagine a whole world of things happening. We can hear a complete description of what's happening. You know, we hear two activities, and they're related and they're connected. The baby's crying, the mummy picks it up. We can hear there's a sequence that the baby crying and then the mother picked it up. That, you know, it wasn't the picking up of the baby that made it cry. We know that. We can understand that and interpret that very simply from these sentences. The categories within those sentences, two sentences, shape how we think about what's happening in there. Okay? We expect the baby to be picked up carefully. We don't expect them to be picked up like that. If you're asked to think about that picture, that's how you expect the baby to be picked up in that first picture. When you think about the mother, you don't expect it to be a gorilla. Okay? There's a presumption it's a human mother and a human baby. Okay? That's not in there. That's something you've read into it. So very simple things. And how the categories shape our description and our interpretation of what's happening. Okay. So you can see there's a real circularity going on here that you need to be part of to do qualitative research. You need to start getting aware of this and start looking for ideas to challenge your understandings, using your data to challenge your understandings. And there's a back and forth. And somewhere along this, at some point, the music stops and you have to write a paper. Okay? But that's how it goes. So, what are we doing when we do our analysis as a sociologist? You know, sociological qualitative research, I would argue, adds value. We're intervening in this in some way, by challenging the categories that are in there and looking at them in different ways. We're doing something that isn't being done by our participants. We ourselves are intervening in that field, and we have to account for that. We have to account that methodologically, and we have to account for that ethically. But what we're looking to do is understand how people understand what it is they're doing and how they account for things. That's the first thing we try and do when we add some value by doing qualitative research. And we're seeking to further our understanding of the meanings. And this is really important. We're looking at meanings here. You know, how people understand what's happening is a meaning-based qualitative research. What sociology also tries to do is try to point to the norms and values built into our understandings, the meanings that we use. So how these structure our understandings and affect them in different ways. And what we try to do is understand the utility of the understandings and the categories and the interpretations people have in their lives as they understand them. So there's not really helpful to walk up to a particular situation and say, well, these people are obviously doing this wrong. Let me understand what it is you're doing wrong, and I will tell you, therefore, how you're doing it wrong. There's too much a priori in that. And my work in complementary and alternative medicine was full of that. Whenever I told people that was the research I was doing, they would, that'd be great because you can tell them how to stop using homeopathy. Well, yeah, I know it doesn't work, but what I'm really interested in is, what if they know that and they keep using it? How is it that they understand it to be working is a very different question to, does homeopathy work? But it was sociologically extremely interesting. Okay? So what we need to try and do is understand, as I put there, the logic of the field or the context, as the people in that context understand it for themselves. And if we can start to do that, first up, we've taken a big step forward in understanding our social world and then what's happening. Some of the ways we can do that, I talk about developing reflexivity. This is an ongoing project. If you become a qualitative researcher, it's almost a life's vocation, because you have spent a lot of time trying to think about your biases, your pre-understandings, categories you use, how you might understand something differently. And, you know, that's one of the joys of it. You get to pop into the history department, listen to a really interesting lecture there. You can talk to the political department and get some really interesting ideas about, you know, the micro-politics, things that might be happening. And you, as a sociologist, you're constantly reading other people's work from different fields. It doesn't have to be your own field, to find out other ways that people are understanding the things that are happening. And you build up this sensitivity, or the sociological imagination, sociologists often refer to it. Develop your inner social scientist. This is the contribution you can bring to qualitative research. You can start to understand the world in slightly different ways. So that is about as technical, theoretical as we get. The next bit is just working through a long example, because I don't know what Anne-Marie's been telling you, but I think qualitative research is best learnt by doing it. You need to be engaged in it. You can read as much as you can about it and about the various techniques, but until you're doing it, you don't really understand your own biases. You don't understand your own the own blind spots that you have when you're doing your research. So by doing it, you can start to engage with those and understand how it is you engage with a particular piece of data. Okay. But do we have any questions about what I've said so far? I raced through that, sorry. Brilliant. Right, clear as day. Or asleep. So, the example. Very simple question. How might we understand an account of miscast diagnosis? Chosen this very simply because it's something I'm working on at the moment, and I have a nice little clip that works really nicely for this, and it's a good little exercise. So hopefully it's of interest to most of you. Most people here will be have a health interest to their qualitative research. So there we go. So just by way of context, so I'm not coming to this blind. Grounded theory would argue that you come to it, you know, and you work your way up and you get through your literature. But most of the time in our research lives, we've done a lot of reading beforehand. We've applied for money, so we've had to do a huge amount of work. We've got a really good idea of what we're thinking about when we hit the field and do some data collection. So just thinking from that point of view, I know these particular things about the healthcare context that may or may not be affecting how people think about cancer diagnosis. So we know the structural and economic pressures in healthcare. We know that how acute that is right now, but these are things that have been going on for the last 10, 20 years in different ways. We know the fantastic advances in biosciences and biomedicine, but that poses particular challenges for how we understand science and how that's communicated to patients when they're getting their diagnosis and what they understand to be happening. Often, if the doctor is not 100% sure, as we see, specialisation of clinical knowledge, it can be quite difficult for the patient to understand what exactly is happening. And we can think about that in terms of a lot of oncology specialists will be specialised in a particular form of oncology than other parts. We also know there's dangers of over-investigation, over-diagnosis and over-treatment. And these might be particular breaks on how people go through a healthcare system and about how clinicians are thinking about what should be done and how patients might be thinking about how things should be done. We also know patient empowerment, choice and responsibility are really big issues for today's healthcare, how we think about healthcare, orientates around these things, and that's had an effect on the doctor-patient relationship in terms of relational practices, shared decision-making, patient-centered care. So this is just the literature that's out there. These are some of the things that are in our head when we get to our data. So here's an example. I'm going to switch the lights off so you can see this. What I want you to think about, this is a short 2-minute clip of Kylie, and that's the Australian connection coming through. But well, just think about what she's talking about and how we might understand it, and just start to think about some themes you might use to code what you're hearing. Okay, you've done a class in coding. Most people, just think about what might be happening there. So, okay, so the interview continues. That's enough data. Okay, so that's what we're thinking about. So, I've done the transcribing, so you don't need to do that. I've also given it a quick edit to remove some of the chat. Maybe if we're doing a conversation analysis, we could analyse the really awful interviewing technique there as somebody tells somebody something really private and they just go, oh. it's taken me years of watching that video to get over the cringe every time I watch it. I've removed a few bits and pieces to give us a nice compact bit of text there to just work on. And this is going to, like I say, it's a simplified approach just to give you an idea of how we build up and out in our analysis. So this is the text. And just in case for the podcast, that video is not allowed on, I'm going to read this out. I was misdiagnosed initially. So my message to all of you and everyone at home is, because someone is in a white coat and using big, you know, medical instruments doesn't necessarily mean they're right. And the amount of stories that I've heard of women going for diagnosis have been told, don't you worry about a thing, it's fine. I don't want to say that to frighten people, but it's just a fact. I guess you follow your intuition, and if you have any doubt, go back again. Okay, that's what we're going to spend the rest of this time looking at. So what anticipated themes might we be thinking about? If we're going to do our analysis, we've got all these things in the background of our head. How, if we're going to code this data, what themes would we use to code it? You sat in front of NVivo, you've got your coding frame open, type something. Diagnosis, yeah, okay. What sort of, on here, I would think about these things. I mean, we've got advances in bioscience and medicine, specialisation, clinical knowledge. So I'm thinking about knowledgey things. I'm going to think about the data in terms of what knowledge is known and used where. Empowerment seems to be quite important to the field and to Kylie. So I'm going to think about empowerment and responsibility. These seem key themes. And I'm also going to talk about shared decision making or something around this sort of area here. So I'm just going to use the word shared and bundle things in there. Okay. So that's why I came up with responsibility, power, knowledge and sharing as my rough codes. Absolutely, could come up with completely different ones. Okay, but this is part of the qualitative process. Is you're going to approach this with a particular view, and this is your understanding of the literature and what you want to get out of this data. So are these the right questions? And you put your codes together and then you tackle the data.
I think that trust is a big issue there.
Yeah.
Trust to the professional.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, and absolutely would, you know, think about that in that way and could have a fifth one, trust. I mean, I could absolutely put in, what else could we put in? Choice and choosing in healthcare is a key theme. What I've done is just simplify it again, just choosing four and not exhausting my list just to go through this talk. But that decision already is orientating me to the data to think about it in a particular way. Okay, I need to be clear to myself why I'm doing that, so that if somebody asks me, I can explain to them. Now, I know from my own experience, usually the first set of codes you come up with, you get halfway through your first or second interview, and you realise these are really not working. Okay, this is not helping. This isn't going right. So you put them in the bin, you start again, and you think of some other codes. And you can do that 2 or 3 times. And I've done that with colleagues here. We spend a lot of time thinking about the codes we might use, how they interact with the data, how that shapes our understanding of that data, and then deciding, actually, it doesn't seem to be working too well. Let's try some other codes. But for this exercise, I'm just going to keep it simple and look at 4. Okay? So, here we go. Here's my text. Let's take that first sentence. You might want to write those down. Responsibility, power, knowledge, and sharing. So I'm going to ask you to code this text with me. Okay? So, the first one, first sentence, I was misdiagnosed initially. How would you code that? Where, what? Is that going in responsibility, power, knowledge, or sharing? And drag it across an en vivo. You can put it in one.
Knowledge.
Top of the class. That's exactly how I would put it. I could understand other people putting it somewhere else, but for the purpose of this exercise, I'm only going to put it in one. I'm going to put it in there. Whoop. Oh, well. The next one. So my message to all of you and everyone at home is, I've put that in responsibility, I think. Sharing, sorry, of course. So this is about sharing her story with other people, and this is how, you know, I just could have categorised that in there. What's the next one? Because someone is in a white coat and using, you know, medical instruments doesn't necessarily mean they're right.
Power.
Power, okay. That I'd go for. I think I went for power too. Hey! This is great. I mean, if we were doing integrated reliability, we'd be doing very well, but I don't do that. And the amount of stories that I've heard of women going for a diagnosis and being told, don't worry about a thing, it's fine. So we've got power, knowledge, responsibility, and sharing.
Sharing?
Sharing, yeah. Again, it's about telling stories. Stories are a sharing thing. So I would be happy to pop it in there for now. I don't want to say that to frighten people, but that's just a fact.
Knowledge?
Yeah, it's about what is and is not knowledge. And if you follow your intuition and you have any doubt, again, there are two types of understanding, two types of knowledge. And then the last one, go back again. Or if you have any doubt, go back again. Yeah. But it's the only place it sort of features. And even though I said we're not double coding, I double coded. So, because it, just to make sense of go back again, if you have any doubt, go back again. So that's just going to help me when it comes to it. So there you go. You've done your first bit of analysis. You've got your data. You've coded it. And you've broken it all up into these various bits and pieces. Now we're going to start doing more up and out and how we're going to analyse this. So we take our first code, knowledge. We've got en vivo to spit it out at us. I was misdiagnosed initially. I don't want to say that to frighten people, but it's just a fact. I guess you follow your intuition if you have any doubt. So just keep it very simple, step by step. Just describe that data to yourself. Just write a little paragraph, paraphrasing that, using as much as you can the participant's words. So medicine can and does get things wrong, and this is something we should recognise as true. Your intuition can be a basis upon which you act. Just describing what Kylie's saying there, okay? Not trying to be judgmental about it, I'm not trying to do too much, just trying to describe what I see, say what you see. Then we can start to do some interpretation, we can start to add some value, okay? I start to use some of the sociological imagination that I've got, some of the knowledge I've got, to interpret what might be happening there. Just, you know, again, thinking you've got your data in front of you, you can jot some ideas down. Individual experience brings about doubt about medical knowledge and authority. She doesn't use the words medical knowledge or authority, but I'm interpreting what's happening there as to using those two categories. I'm starting to order the data as I see it. Establishment of personal experience as a neutral observation of the accuracy of diagnostic medicine. So her experience means that diagnostic medicine might not be always right. Okay, this is a fact. No, when she says this is a fact, she's not trying to scare people. This is just something that did happen. And the use of her subjective experience, her intuition, is suggested as a basis for interpreting doubt. Something along those lines. So, you know, doubt is something she can understand and she's interpreting. It's her intuition is an interaction going on there of some sort about how she understands what's happening. And again, I've used the term subjective experience. That's my categorization. I need to think about why I'm using those terms and what they mean to me. But that's how I want to interpret that. And I've done that for all of these categories, sharing. So my message to all of you and everyone at home is, the amount of stories that I've heard of women going for a diagnosis, being told, don't you worry about a thing, it's fine. Again, very simple. Just do a paraphrase description. Through the story she has heard, shared, she has come to understand that this is also the experience of others. That's what she's telling us. You know, I'm not trying to use any terms that are alien to the quotes themselves. But when I start to interpret that, what do I know about stories? I know stories can be, sharing of stories can be an empowering act. as they're demonstrated through the actual performance of telling one's own story. So we have to remember there's more than one story going on there. She's recounting the stories of other people that have told her, but she's also telling a story to Ellen, the audience, and the people at home. So there's, you know, different storytelling things going on there, stories about stories. And these can be empowering acts, and we know that in the Me Too campaign at the moment. You know, people telling their story helps them own what's happening. You know, it's part of that. So this is this empowering act. And again, she doesn't talk about this about being an empowering act or performativity or all these things. This is something now how I'm seeing what she's doing. I'm starting to interpret that using my own knowledge. And the message for everyone, the audience, you know, we all have this in common. She says this for everybody here and everybody at home. There's no distinguishing between, oh, this is just for people here, this is just for women, this is just for Americans, everybody. So she's categorising who she's talking to, the subject of this, in the sociological terms, has this particular thing in common. There's a commonality we all share. Because someone is in a white coat using big, you know, medical instruments doesn't necessarily mean they are right. Okay, and again, just a brief description of that. Despite what they know and how they come across, doctors are not the only way to know what is right. Okay? There's a challenge if the doctor says patient does, sort of idea there. By questioning the medical symbols, and again, she doesn't talk about medical symbols, I've interpreted these different things as symbols of medicine. Okay? This is the message she's giving out to people. You have a right to question and go back if you're not sure. Go back to the doctors, but the person doing the questioning is you. You have that responsibility to think about that in that way. And doubts and not knowing are based on subjective knowledge are a legitimate way to basis to question and take action. You don't need to go back to your clinician with, you know, your homemade blood test or something, okay? Just having enough doubt about what's going on and to question them is legitimate, okay? Which is a different way to thinking about, perhaps, how we think about what patients should and shouldn't do, okay? So it's trying to understand this context from Kylie's point of view, okay? And how she's made sense of what's happened to her. So, what I did is that. So, okay, so what I'm going to do now is just bring all that together and show you how you would write that up. So a little bit more working up and out. And then I'm going to start to engage some of the data, some of the literature, which starts to address some of these questions about power and medical establishment and all these sort of things. So, just I've taken those descriptive bits, popped them into a paragraph, move them around to make grammatical sense and what have you, but essentially we have, you know, and this would go into your findings section at some point, you know, and just describing the data. Kelly's account describes how much medicine can and does get things wrong, and that is something we should all recognise as true. Through the story she has shared, she has come to understand that this is also the experience of others. Doctors, with their symbols of medical authority, not the only way to know what is true. She explains that there are times when your intuition can be a basis upon which you act, and that you have an individual responsibility to act upon your doubts. And actually, I should take that out, because that's not what she says. So I can see how I've already written this and how I would edit it again and proof it and edit it, but that's part of the process. This is where things start to get interesting, I would say, because this is where we start to add some value in terms of how we're thinking about it. I'm now going to think about what she's done in terms of the categories that are in my head and about how I understand the literature around people acting in terms of getting their cancer diagnosis. Part of that, I'm not going to talk about Kyla, I'm going to talk about this participant or this person. I'm starting to recognise that this voice is my voice now. It's me interacting with this data. So I'm not trying to pretend that this is Kylie's account of what's happening. I am adding stuff to this, okay? And I need to respect that in the way I write it. This person's experience has brought her to doubt medical knowledge and authority, an outcome that has reasons to be a neutral observation about the accuracy of diagnostic medicine. Questioning medical symbols can be seen to take both authority and responsibility away from the medical establishment. The use of subjective experience, intuition, is suggested as a legitimate basis for interpreting her doubts. What is also notable is the place that sharing stories has, both the act of listening and performing of telling in this account have been empowering acts. Moreover, the message proffered is for everyone. This suggests an audience with something in common. So I'm starting to read into this, think about it in particular, using particular sociological categories. And I'm going to come back to this in a second and show you how I've done that. In recognising this, and this, I've separated this paragraph out because I started, when I was writing this, I thought, now I'm going to just push it a little bit further. Okay? In recognising this, we can point to how individual subjective acts, so Callie's description of what she's doing, drawn an imagined collective of citizens. She's imagining that other people are like her, are in a similar situation, who mobilise a language of subjective awareness as a basis upon which to doubt medical authority and take responsibility to preserve their health. Okay? So really push that interpretation. Okay? And I'll show you a little bit how I've done that. Okay, for time. So, I'm going to come back to that in a sec. Just to recap where we're up to, we're moving up. As you can see, we're moving further and further away from the original data, but we're adding value by thinking about that, using different categories to think about what is happening there and make a little bit strange what's going on. Start to think about how we might interpret it in different ways. What we need to think about now also is that we're not just dealing with this data, we're dealing with a whole load of literature as well. We're not the first people to look at this. We're not the first people to think about healthcare and patients' relationships with their clinicians. So we need to go back to that data that we started with, that literature we started with, and start to interact with that one as we're doing our writing and our thinking. Okay? And the way I would ask my question to myself is, how is this data problematising the preconceived ideas or concepts as understood in the literature? So I'm not looking to say this is an example of medicalisation. You know, I want to think about how this may or may not be medicalisation, and we'll take that forward. So how have I moved out? I'm starting to move out of this data a little bit, if you like, by engaging the literature and thinking about it using sociological concepts or other ideas. I've put in bold sort of key terms where I've added and interpreted what's happening. You know, terms like medical knowledge and authority speak to a particular literature as much as they do to the data. They bridge that space. Medical authority, responsibility, interpretation, all these different key words all speak to a different type of literature and organise my data and my thinking about that data in a particular way. When you read a paragraph like this, when you're picking up qualitative research, you can see that, or what you start to see, you know, if this was a film, that little filter would happen and these words would start to jump out at you. You start to see, oh, this is where the author's adding their bit, this is what they're doing. They're using these particular terms in these ways so that I can understand the data slightly differently than the way it's originally put. So, just to move towards the outs, this would be a whole other lecture. And, you know, if Amory invites me back, I'll do that one. But how do we go back to the literature? Do I got another slide? No. So if we went back to that original that slide with the background, I could go back and go, right, well, these are the literatures I might want to talk to and pick up this account and start to engage with that. Or I could go and look at these other things that are out there that people are talking about that this might talk to. I mean, you know, is Kylie's account an example of medicalisation? You know, to get into that, we need to know a lot more about medicalisation and how people think about it. The Bushfield article is excellent for that. References at the end of this. But we could say she's moving away from medical establishment. She's talking about taking her own position, that this isn't medicalisation at all, that she's putting a lot of distance between the patient and medicine. But we can also see that, you know, she doesn't get away from medicine either. She thinks of it through those terms, about going back, about how she's engaging her body. You know, that language is part of being drawn into the medical discourse. She doesn't go off and look for complementary medicines. You know, she's thinking about it in a particular way. So we can interrogate this data through that concept and go back to that interpretation paragraph and completely rewrite it and to think about those things. And we could do that with all these other things. But I won't go through them all at this point because we're nearly out of time and want some discussion. So, hopefully, as I said at the beginning, it was a really simple message and hopefully I've confused you enough, but we get to the end and you sort of go, yeah, okay, I can still live with that. Okay, I might not agree with how you've done it, and that's brilliant. That's exactly how it should be. You should be able to see enough in what I've done to understand how I've done it and to disagree with it. Okay? Hopefully, at times I will convince you. And in times of my career, other people will read my work and go, yeah, go on. That's fine. I can see how you've got there, and I agree. But you can see there's an intellectual craft there. Okay? It does take practice, and it does involve a particular amount of rigour. You have to show how you've done it. That's often down to the journal as much as anything. But if you need, if somebody comes back to you and says, how did you get here? As you did, how did you get here? You know, I can't follow you. I need to be able to explain myself to you. And if I can't, then there's something wrong with the process I've gone through. And that's the qualitative, that's the rigor of qualitative research, is being able to explain how I got from here, this data, to this interpretation. If you can't do that, there is a problem. That does take creativity, and it does take inspiration sometimes. You do need to go to other places. You do need to challenge your thinking, and if you need to find ways to do that, that are creative and can sometimes feel inspired, that's, you know, that's part of the process. But it must be a reflexive process. You must be thinking about it. You can't put it into a computer and let it spit it out at the other end. You need to understand your place and how you've interacted with that data and being able to account for that in your write-up. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for putting up with that. Any questions?